This is going to sound kind of obvious, but just because people use economic terms interchangeably doesn't mean they actually are. Why, yes. Yes, it is a trade story. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 1st of May. Glad, as always, to have you along for the ride, everybody. The current state of play of the Trump administration's steel and aluminum tariffs goes like this. Come see me, basically, in a month. The White House has given Argentina, Australia, and Brazil open-ended exemptions to the 25 and 10% tariffs. Canada, Mexico, and the EU, the European Union, are off the hook until the 1st of June. South Korea, another major source of imported steel to this country, has already scored itself a permanent pass by agreeing to restrict its steel and aluminum exports to the United States, a quota, or a cap, if you will. And that is the deal the Trump administration is offering to Europe and its NAFTA partners as well. If you don't want tariffs, the White House says, then agree to a quota. The thing is, there is quite the bit of economic difference between the two, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
In theory, quotas and tariffs should get you to the same place. Tariffs raise prices and therefore likely lower demand, meaning fewer imports. Quotas restrict supply and therefore also raise prices. Bill Reinsch with the Center for Strategic and International Studies says both give some protection from foreign competition. But in practice, there are lots of other things to consider.
Tariffs are simple. You put a percentage tariff on and they pay the duty.
With quotas, there's no tariff revenue for the importing country to collect. Plus,
in a quota regime, there's a lot more decisions you have to make.
And typically, it's the exporting country that gets to make these decisions, which is why they might prefer quotas to tariffs. Decisions like which companies get to sell how much of their product and what types of products get shipped. This can be key. In the 1980s, Japan agreed to voluntarily restrict its exports of cars to the U.S. Emily Blanchard is a professor at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business.
I actually teach a case where we talk about it, where we say one of the potential unintended consequences was that Japanese auto manufacturers sort of moved earlier into the higher luxury market.
Higher value, higher margin products.
And that's where all the money is.
Kal Krishna, an econ professor at Penn State, says Japan may have even benefited from that quota. But none of these quotas are supposed to happen anymore.
Quotas as such are also illegal.
Oh yeah, quotas happen to be a big no-no under World Trade Organization rules, and they could very well be challenged there. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
All right, a little bit more about Japan here. Japanese steel is not on the exemption list the White House put out last night. And while only 5% or so of the steel that does come in the United States is imported from Japan, if that's your key ingredient, those tariffs have put you in a bind.
Literally, they are the only ones in the world.
Daniel O'Malley is the president of Blade Gallery. It's a marketplace for high-quality knives. The company also makes, at small-scale, specialty knives, like really small-scale, a dozen handmade knives a year. They also do import a special laminated steel only made in Japan to sell to other custom knife makers here. The president's tariff announcement came so far out of left field for them that they've got a prepaid shipment of steel they couldn't get into this country.
Our steel is still sitting in Japan. We've missed several shows where we were hoping to sell the steel to custom knife makers.
Sarah Dukmejian is the president of Steelscape. That's a West Coast manufacturer of steel products for the construction industry. Again, one whose materials come from Japan. Those materials then go into commercial and residential construction here.
The ultimate impact is the cost of building a building, whether it's putting a new roof, a new metal roof on your home, or constructing a school or an airport. The cost of that has gone up.
All these tidbits we've been sharing the past, week or so, I guess, come from companies who filed for their own exemptions to the steel and aluminum tariffs. 3,500 requests so far. You can read some of them at regulations.gov. Forget not the Europeans in all this steel back and forth. Remember, French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Angela Merkel each spent time at the White House last week making their case for permanent exemptions. Didn't get them, and the Europeans are not amused, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
At least one European politician, British Trade Minister Liam Fox, did express relief at yesterday's last-minute temporary reprieve.
I'm delighted that there's a 30-day extension now for us to try to get a longer-term deal with the US, and I'm glad that we've got a breathing space on that.
The European Union's response was less upbeat. It repeated it won't negotiate with the US under the threat of tariffs. And Charles de Lusignan, who speaks for the European steel industry, complained about another month of uncertainty.
This is going to cause havoc further with how to anticipate production, but also how to anticipate what's going to come in at ports and how to deal with that.
There's fear the tariffs will cause a surge of steel exports originally destined for the US to end up in Europe instead, perhaps as much as 25 million tonnes worth. Gareth Stace of the UK Steel Association.
25 million tonnes coming to the EU would severely destabilise our market, drive down prices and threaten jobs.
Of course, Europe could follow South Korea's example and accept quotas on its exports to the US. But Stace says that with a big trading bloc like the EU, quotas won't work.
How do you divide them up? Is that by European member state? Is that per month? Is that per year?
Today, the EU called for its permanent exemption from the tariffs and once again condemned what it called this unilateral action by a long-standing friend and ally. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was a whole lot of moving around. Major indices finished split. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Among the many, many things President Trump has said about immigration since he took office is that he has repeatedly and publicly admired a skills-based immigration policy where it's easier for skilled workers to get in. Canada does it. It's points-based up there technically, but as so often happens with things of, about, or related to economics, there have been some unintended side effects, including this. Lots of high-skilled workers can mean a low-skilled labor shortage. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth reports now from Montreal.
Richard Vigneault has a problem. He's a spokesperson for Olimel, one of the biggest food processing companies in Canada.
Olimel, it's called O-L-Y-M-E-L.
And here's the problem. Olimel has hundreds of positions it can't fill for going on 2 years now.
If you go into Quebec City now, the unemployment rate is only 2.7%. This is full employment, so you don't find anyone. It's very tough to find new employees.
Especially for low-skilled jobs. Olimel's got engineers and PhDs. What it needs is people to drive trucks, pluck chickens, raise pigs, and work the production line. This is a nationwide problem, and it's especially pronounced in Quebec. Yves-Thomas Dorval heads up Quebec's Conseil du Patronat, sort of a chamber of commerce.
We have 1 million jobs to fill for the next 5 years.
1 million jobs in Quebec province alone, which has a smaller population than New York City. Now, a classic fix for a labor shortage is import more workers, which Canada does, but... here's the second part of the problem.
So tell me, the point-based immigration system, it does not favor low skills, is that correct?
Correct.
Canada took nearly 300,000 immigrants in 2016, half of them through this points system, which favors advanced degrees and qualifications. Now Canada's getting a new lower-skilled labor supply from an unlikely source.
Thousands of Haitians fleeing this country and going to Canada.
The Trump administration announcing it is ending Haiti's coverage under TPS.
Temporary protected status.
Every year, it's about 1,000 Haitians coming, and last summer it was 12,000.
Marjorie Villefranche directs Maison d'Haïti, a Haitian community organization. She says the last time Canada saw an influx like this of Haitians was after the horrible earthquake there in 2010. In Canada, asylum seekers present themselves at the border for arrest and processing. This summer, Quebec officials are expecting up to 400 a day.
How long from the moment they get arrested until they learn about Maison d'Haïti?
How long? At the border.
Asylum seekers coming from the U.S. can expect the immigration court and appeals process to take 2 to 3 years. And in the meantime, they're allowed to work. Villefranche says companies come recruiting at Maison d'Haïti all the time, including Olimel, the food processor we heard from earlier.
Ah, tu parles anglais?
Mais oui, un peu, on va essayer.
Okay, we can switch to a little English then?
Yeah.
Haitian citizen Mark Melfort arrived in the U.S. in 2013 and worked as a driver, first in Georgia, then Virginia. But when the Trump administration announced it would end his temporary protected status, he figured Canada would be a safer bet.
Yeah, 100%, yeah. They had the president say, no immigrant. They don't want immigrant, you know. That's why they come here, they get afraid.
He's at Maison d'Haïti today to meet with Olimel about a job on one of its pig farms. He says he feels valued the company is seeking him out. And he adds America could learn something from the example.
Without immigrants, country not going to be okay, you know.
Olimel currently employs more than 200 Haitians who crossed into the country illegally last summer. They may have to leave after 2 or 3 years, but for now they're providing a valuable service. The asylum seekers couldn't come to Canada through the regular system, but after crossing illegally, they've become essential. In Quebec, I'm Ryan Kailoth for Marketplace.
Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who's on his way to China tonight to talk tariffs with Beijing, made a stop here in L.A. yesterday on his way to a big finance get-together, the Milken Conference, if you know it. And he said something that caught our ear, especially in light of some news late this afternoon. So first of all, here is what he said yesterday.
If a company has excess capital, they return that capital to shareholders. This group recycles that capital through the economy. It doesn't disappear. So there's nothing wrong with stock buybacks.
All right. So again, that was yesterday, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. Then this afternoon, Apple reported quite nice quarterly profits and said it's also going to return some of its ginormous pile of cash, excess capital, as the Treasury Secretary said. It's $100 billion, give or take. A lot of it had been overseas. It's going to give it back to shareholders in the form of buybacks and dividends. So we thought we'd test this Treasury Secretary's premise that stock buybacks are all well and good. Here's Marketplace's Amy Scott.
When a public company has extra cash, it can sit on it, spend it, or give it back to shareholders by paying dividends or buying back stock.
There's nothing wrong with buybacks in theory.
Nell Minow is a longtime shareholder advocate with Value Edge Advisors. She says if a company's stock price is lower than insiders think it's worth, buybacks can boost the share price. And if a board doesn't have better ideas for the money, it makes sense to return it to shareholders. But stocks are way up. And Minow says,
that's a pretty sad statement about American corporations, that they have no ideas about what to do with the cash to, say, increase the pay or the benefits for their employees, to put into research and development.
According to S&P, companies are on track to return $1 trillion to shareholders this year. NYU economist Edward Wolf says that's great for the richest 10% of Americans who own more than 80% of stock.
Anything that augments stock prices, those benefits flow almost entirely the very wealthy.
But economist Douglas Holtz Aiken with the American Action Forum says what really matters is where that money goes next.
Does it go into the financial system, get picked up by a firm, generate higher productivity and higher wages for workers, or doesn't it?
A tax holiday in the mid-2000s brought back billions of dollars in overseas profits. Holtz Aiken says companies bought back a lot of stock, but the economy and employment grew. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's the kind of sale that it's going to be fun just to watch as theater alone.
Because there are going to be some high-priced items. First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, a little bit rocky today. The Dow Industrials ended the day down just 0.2%, about 64 points, 24,099. The NASDAQ added about 0.9%, 64 points, 71.30. The S&P 500 picked up 0.2%, 6 points, finished at 26.54. All right, so some earnings starting with Apple. iPhone sales were solid. Revenue was up 16%. Shares up 4% after the bell. No such happy ending for Tapestry, the parent company of Coach and Kate Spade. Shares unraveled nearly 12% on weak same-store sales for Kate Spade. Snap's redesign not doing the trick. Revenue less than expected. Outlook not so good. Shares down more than 16% after the bell. Bond prices fell just a touch. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.95%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There's a story in the new edition of Wired magazine that's a little bit corporate espionage, a little bit hacking, all right, a lot of hacking, and a whole bunch of video game. Brendan Koerner tells the story of a would-be legit game programmer named David Pecora and the Xbox hacking economy. Brendan, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
I guess maybe the place to start is with a little biography of this guy, David Pecora, sort of the protagonist of this piece. Who was he?
Yeah, so he's a young computer programmer from Mississauga, Ontario, up in Canada. At a very young age, at 2 years old, he started playing first-person shooter games on his parents' off-brand PC and really became fascinated by how this beige box on his parents' coffee table was able to translate his physical emotions into animation on a screen. He was obviously a born programmer. And as he got older, he became fascinated with delving into the code of games, which he was obsessed with. And he really became a master of manipulating these games to do whatever he wanted them to do.
And he eventually, I guess the word is, specializes in the Xbox, right? And he starts with a bunch of benign-ish playing around with it that was generally accepted by the larger community and in some ways by the company itself.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Very quickly after that console's debut, hackers figured out they could route around the security measures and really manipulate the code and manipulate the games and make them behave as they wished. David got on this train. He started doing this. He fiddled around with Halo 2 in particular, wrote some tools that let you change the weather in the game and change
like, all sorts. Like rain and sun and snow and all that, right?
Yeah,
just the weather?
He could change a sunny day into a rainstorm.
Wow.
And so that was really what he started out with. And he actually impressed people who worked for Microsoft and game developers. And they would write to him after he posted his exploits on forums. And they would say, hey, you did a great job with this, and really encourage him to keep on hacking.
Okay, and I don't want to give away sort of the rest of the story because it's a long one and it's a good one, but it turns dark, this relationship he has with Xbox, and it becomes, in fact, criminal. And my question is, how does, and this is a community-wide question, right? How does this happen, that it goes from a collegial kind of thing to actively stealing, I guess, some of this technology?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is the introduction of money into this ecosystem of hackers. In 2010, you have the new Xbox called the Xbox 360 gets compromised. And all of a sudden, 23 million online players can hack their games and behave how they wish in these online experiences. And David Pecora and some of his friends who've had years of experience decide they can sell cheats to these players. And they can make upwards of $8,000 a day. A hacker from Australia contacts David and basically says, hey, I have some passwords to get into a game developer named Epic Games in North Carolina. So they start roaming these networks and they find that every game developer is jacked into other developers or even into, say, the Pentagon, the U.S. Army. And they start roaming from network to network, taking software as they go.
These games, we ought to point out, cost the companies, whether it's Epic or Activision or, I mean, whoever's making them, tens and tens of millions of dollars. So this is, in some way, theft of IP, right? Intellectual property.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So this wasn't just a matter of a game leaking onto a torrent site a few days in advance of its release. Mm. They were getting beta copies of these games months and months and months in advance. These are, as you said, games that cost $60 million to produce easily. And these companies were very concerned about their IP and certainly competitors getting access to their source code early on, maybe mimicking what they do. So it's a big business, and this was big money theft.
Without giving away the end of the story, what happens to Dave Pecora?
It's really a story of how obsession can have tragic consequences. Mr. Pecora actually ends up being imprisoned as a result of his actions, and the people around him suffer even graver consequences. What attracted me to the story in the first place was the fact that these young men really did think of it all as a game, in essence, mm-hmm. as fun. And ultimately, the price they paid was very, very steep for a lot of them.
Brendan Koerner writes for Wired, his most recent piece is kind of an amazing tale of this Xbox hacking thing. It's called The Young and the Reckless. Brendan, thanks a lot for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
David Rockefeller, the last surviving grandson of John D., died a little bit more than a year ago. And when he did, having been predeceased by his wife Peggy, the estate the couple left behind was a big one. Today, Christie's Auction House began selling the Rockefellers' collection of art and valuables. It'll be online through next Tuesday, and then a couple of days of live auctions. All told, proceeds are expected to be at least $500 million. Some are saying as much as $1 billion. All of it to go to charities that the Rockefellers supported. Ashley Milne-Tite has a preview.
The excitement at Christie's is palpable as a group of visitors embarks on a tour of items from the late David and Peggy Rockefeller's homes and gardens. An estate sale like this one is rare. It includes many hundreds of items, paintings, jewelry, furniture, and porcelain.
And eventually, Peggy and David are able to gather this over 150-piece dinner service, which they really used and loved.
Christie's porcelain specialist Becky McGuire is showing us a gilt-edged dinner service with intricately drawn figures shown in a garden or country landscape. It was made in China in the early 19th century. The Rockefellers collected it piece by piece for many years.
And you never, never see such an enormous service of it. We're thrilled to have it.
The price is estimated at $100,000 to $150,000. But that's a bargain compared to some of the auction's other treasures. Upstairs, Christie's chairman Mark Porter walks me over to a painting that hung in the Rockefellers' living room for 60 years.
She's extraordinary.
We're looking at a Matisse from 1923. In it, a model reclines on a couch, half naked. The mood is sensual.
A Matisse of this quality, scale, and perfection of image hasn't been on the market in four decades.
Porter says Christie's is expecting this work to sell for $70 million, and possibly a lot more. A Picasso in the sale is expected to fetch $100 million. Sarah Douglas is editor-in-chief of Art News magazine. She says the allure of this auction isn't just the exceptional quality of the art, it's where it came from. Take several of the Picassos, once owned by writer Gertrude Stein.
She was close with Picasso, got it directly from Picasso. So you're talking about not only an extremely pristine provenance, but let's say a star-studded provenance.
The auction house has toured parts of the collection within the US and in Europe, Hong Kong, Beijing, and Shanghai. Last year, Asia became the second largest market for art sales behind the US.
So I think people are going to be watching China for who's going to be buying these really, really major pieces.
Though we may never know their names, buyers often remain anonymous. Betsy Bickar is an art advisor at City Private Bank. She says some of her clients will be bidding at the auction. They've waited years for an opportunity like this.
It's the kind of sale that it's going to be fun just to watch as theater alone.
She says wealthy individuals will be vying for the Matisses and Monets, not arts institutions.
I think if a museum were to acquire one of these works, it would be with the help of a benefactor. So, you know, museums certainly don't have acquisitions budgets that large.
Not that you need a vast budget for everything in the collection. Some of the family items are small and personal, with a nod to the Rockefellers' luxurious lifestyle. Mark Porter shows me a pair of David Rockefeller's gold cufflinks, which he says could go for at least $400. They're made
in the shape of martini glasses. The liquid is depicted by a triangular cut precious stone.
A window into one of America's wealthiest families and a glimpse at a gilded past. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of I am not even kidding. This item, Facebook is having its big developer conference today and tomorrow, F8 it's called. CEO Mark Zuckerberg gave the keynote today. He talked about the Russians and actual fake news and Cambridge Analytica. And then, well, this.
So today, we are announcing a new set of features coming soon around dating. Now, this is going to be for building real long-term relationships, all right? Not just hookups.
Not just hookups, he said. Now, Zuckerberg swore up and down privacy and safety would be built in, which is fine, be that as it may. But two thoughts. Number one, is now really the time for this company to do this? And number two, I'm pretty sure people already use Facebook for dating, right? So doesn't this just let the company monetize those people a little bit better? Not just hookups, gang. Dow Industrials off 0.2% today, 64 points. NASDAQ up 0.9, about 64 points there. S&P 500 picked up 0.2, 6 points. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.